thought you'd like it back, Theo says, adding with a grin, even though we've only just met. I cup the bracelet in my hand. I've had it for such a long time. It's been my devoted companion for more than half my life. But it's time to say goodbye. Now that I know the truth, I won't be needing it anymore. Thank you, I say. But
what?
I think I've outgrown it. Besides, I know a better place for it. Without a second thought, I toss the bracelet into the air, the three birds taking flight at last. I close my eyes before it lands. I don't want the memory of seeing it vanish from view. Instead, I listen, reaching for Theo's hand, as the bracelet drops with a light splash into the depths of Lake Midnight. This is how it ends. Franny passes away on a muggy evening in late September. She dies not at the lake, but in the bedroom of her penthouse at the Harris. Theo and Lottie are with her. According to Theo, her last words are, "I'm ready." A week later, you attend her funeral on a Monday that's been kissed by Indian summer. You think Franny would have appreciated that. After the service, you and Theo go for a walk in Central Park. You haven't seen him since leaving Camp Nightingale. With everything that was going on, both of you agreed that space and time were necessary. Now, a host of unspoken emotions hangs over the reunion. There's grief, of course, and happiness at seeing each other. And another stranger feeling, trepidation. You don't know what kind of relationship the two of you will have going forward, especially when halfway into your walk, Theo says, "I'm going away next week." You come to a sudden stop.
Where?
Africa, Theo says. I signed on for another tour with Doctors Without Borders. 1 year. I think it'll be good for me to get away. I need time to sort things out. You understand. You think it sounds like a fine idea. You wish him well. When I get back, I'd love to have dinner, Theo says.
You mean like a date?
It could just be a casual meal between two friends who have a habit of accusing each other of doing terrible things, Theo replies. But I kind of like the date idea better.
I do too, you say.
That night, you begin to paint again. It strikes you after hours spent lying awake, thinking about changing seasons and the passing of time. You get out of bed, stand before a blank canvas, and realize what you need to do. Paint not what you see, but what you saw. You paint the girls in the same order, always. Vivian first, then Natalie, then Allison. You cover them with sinuous shapes in various shades of blue and green and brown. Moss and cobalt, pewter and pine. You fill the canvas with algae, pond weed, underwater trees with branches twisting toward the surface. You paint a weather-vane-topped building submerged in the chilly depths, dark and empty, waiting for someone to find it. When that canvas is complete, you paint another, then another, and another. Bold paintings of walls and foundations hidden under water, engulfed by plant life, lost to time. Each time you paint over the girls feels like a burial, a funeral. You paint nonstop for weeks. Your wrist aches. Your fingers don't uncurl even when there's not a brush in them. When you sleep, you dream of colors. Your therapist tells you that what you're doing is healthy. You're sorting through your feelings, dealing with your grief. By January, you have completed 21 paintings, your underwater series. You show them to Randall, who's ecstatic. He gasps at each canvas, marvels at how you've outdone yourself. A new gallery show is planned. hastily put together by Randall to capitalize on all the publicity surrounding Lake Midnight. It's set for March. Buzz steadily builds. You're profiled in the New Yorker. Your parents plan to attend. The morning of the opening, you get a phone call from Detective Nathan Flynn. He tells you what you've known all along. The bones discovered in the water belong to Natalie and Allison. What about Vivian? You ask. That's a very good question, Flynn says. He tells you that none of the bones are a match. He tells you that both Natalie's and Allison's skulls were fractured in a way that suggests they were struck in the head, possibly with a shovel found near the bones. He tells you that chains and bricks had also been discovered, indicating both bodies might have been weighed down. He tells you the strand of hair in the plastic baggie you found buried with Vivian's diary is actually processed polyester used mostly in the making of wigs. He tells you that same baggie also contained traces of a laminate and adhesive that were once common in the production of fake IDs. What are you suggesting? You ask. Exactly what you're thinking, he says. What you're thinking about are Vivian's last words to you, when she knocked on Dogwood's locked door. Come on, Em, let me in. Me. That's what she had said. Not us. Meaning that she was alone. You hang up the phone with a queasy feeling in your gut. The conversation leaves you so stunned that you almost opt out of attending that night's opening. Only Mark keeps you from backing out. He nudges you through the motions of getting ready. Shower, slinky blue dress, black heels with red soles. At the gallery, you see that Randall has once again pulled out all the stops. You sip wine and watch shrimp canapes float by on silver trays as you talk to the guy from Christie's, the lady from The Times, the television actress who helped set your career in motion. Sasha, Crystal, and Miranda attend. Mark takes a picture of the four of you, standing in front of your largest painting, number 6, which seems as massive as Lake Midnight itself. Later that night, you're at that very same work when a woman comes up beside you. This is lovely, she says, her eyes on the painting. So beautifully strange. Are you the artist? I am. You glance her way, getting a glimpse of red hair, a striking frame, regal bearing. Her clothes are effortlessly cool. Black dress, black gloves, floppy black hat and a Burberry trench. You think she might be a model. Then you recognize her pert nose and cruel smile and your legs buckle. Vivian? She continues to stare at the painting, speaking in a calm whisper only the two of you can hear. Two truths and a lie, Emma, she says. You ready to play? You want to say no. You have to say yes. 1. Allison and Natalie were with my sister the night she died, she says. They dared her to go out on that ice. They saw her fall in and drown, yet they told no one. But I had my suspicions. I knew Catherine wouldn't do something so dangerous unless she'd been coerced. So I befriended them, earned their trust, pretended to trust them in return. It's how I learned the truth, teasing it out of them on the 4th of July. They swore they tried to help Catherine. I knew they were lying. After all, I pretended to drown in front of everyone. As I flailed in that water, only Theo made a move to help me. Natalie and Allison did nothing. They simply watched, just as they had watched Catherine drown. You think about the day you came back to the cabin and found the girls fighting. You realize now that you had walked into their confession. And contrary to how friendly they had seemed afterward, nothing between them was fine. 2. Since I already suspected what Natalie and Allison had done, I spent a year researching and planning. I learned about the history of Lake Midnight. I found a place no one knew about, a flooded insane asylum. I placed a sweatshirt in the woods to confuse searchers. I fucked the groundskeeper and stole the key to his tool shed. Then I led Allison and Natalie to that secret spot on the lake where no one would ever look. I did to them what they had done to my sister. Now you understand that you misinterpreted her diary. She didn't look for Peaceful Valley to expose its existence. She sought it out because it was the best place to hide her crime. You think about the shovel stolen from the tool shed. You think about fractured skulls resting on the lake bed. You think about the locket, which you now know Vivian dropped into the water because just like you and your bracelet, she no longer needed it. 3. Vivian is dead. Your mouth is so dry with shock you're not sure you can speak. But you do, managing to croak out. The third one. Wrong, she says. Vivian died 15 years ago. Let her rest in peace, Em. She leaves the gallery quickly, her boots clicking against the floor. You follow her, much slower, your legs wobbly from shock. Out on the street, you see a town car streak away from the curb. Tinted windows deny you a good look. No one else is on the block. It's just you and your palpitating heart. Back in the gallery, you murmur your goodbyes to Mark, Randall, all the others. You say you're not feeling well. You blame it on the shrimp you haven't even touched. At home in your studio, you paint all night and into the dawn. You paint until garbage trucks rumble by and the sun peeks over the buildings on the other side of the street. When you stop, you stand before the finished canvas. It's a portrait of Vivian. Not how she looked back then, but how she looks now. Her nose, her chin, her eyes, which you've painted midnight blue. She stares back at you with a coy smile playing across her lips. It's the last time you'll ever paint her. You know that with bone-deep certainty. In a few hours, when the post office opens, you'll ship the painting to Detective Flynn. You'll include a note telling him that Vivian is alive and was last seen in Manhattan. You'll ask that the painting be released to the media, who can use it any way they want. You will expose who she is, how she looks, what she's done. You won't hide her beneath layers of paint. You will refuse to cover her up. The time for lies is over. This is Nicole Zanzarella. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Last Time I Lied by Riley Sager. This program was directed by Richard Brewer, executive producer Dan Musselman. Text copyright 2018 by Todd Ritter. Production copyright 2018, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this program.